This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte is among the top 50 mosquito-plagued cities. We find out why and about a research project studying the best ways to predict mosquito-borne disease outbreaks a little later in the program. First, we look at our water. There's plenty of it today. It's coming down in droves. Charlotte's drinking water comes from Mountain Island Lake and is tested and then treated for 150 contaminants before it reaches households and businesses. Charlotte Water, our water utility, issues a report on water quality every year, and again this year, they report our drinking water meets federal standards. But there have been cities like Flint, Michigan, and recently Wilmington, that have found problems with their water, and one advocacy group has called into question the quality standards used by Charlotte Water. In the first part of the program, we look at those standards and the steps taken to keep our water safe, and Barry Gullett is here. He is the director of Charlotte Water. They oversee drinking water testing and treatment. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
Rusty Brazell is the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Service's Water Quality Program Manager. He oversees the quality of the water source itself. That's before it's treated. Welcome back to you. Also with us is Ron Hargrove. He's Deputy Utilities Director for Charlotte Water. Good morning. And Bruce Henderson is here. He's a reporter for the Charlotte Observer who has covered environmental news for about 20 years. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
You. If you would like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where we're broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning. And get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. All those places are available to you. So, Barry, according to results released in June about tests taken in 2016, Mecklenburg County's drinking water met federal standards for safety and quality. Have we ever failed to meet those standards?
No, we haven't. Charlotte's got great water, and I have all the confidence in the world that it is a good quality product. It's safe to drink. I drink it. My family drinks it. Our employees drink it. Our laboratory staff drinks it that does the analysis. It's good stuff.
You know, we're all sitting around the table here with bottled water. This would not have happened 25 years ago. Why have we gravitated toward bottled water? Is it just a portability convenience, or are people suspicious of the water that comes out of the tap and less so of the water that comes out of these bottles, which in some cases is actually bottled city water?
That's correct. I believe that it's largely convenience. I ask a lot of people, you know, do you drink your tap water? And I get a mixed response. And you know, Charlotte has so many folks that have moved in from other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And a lot of folks are moving here from places where they really had concerns about drinking the tap water, and that was their culture. And so we're trying to be sure that our customers have confidence in our water. You know, we've been working to get our own elected officials, you know, in their meetings at the government center and whatever, to convert from bottled water to drinking our water. And it's been very successful in getting them to do that. And so I think it's a matter of convenience. You're right. Some of the bottled water does start as Charlotte Water product. And the standards are different for bottled water and for municipal water. And municipal water standards are actually more stringent than bottled water standards.
Really?
Yes.
Do you think the average person knows that?
No.
What makes them more stringent?
My understanding is they're regulated by two different groups, that the drinking water is regulated by EPA as a drinking water product, and the bottled water, I believe, is regulated by the FDA mm-hmm. as a food product. And so the testing that we have to do for the water that comes out of your faucet is more frequent and ongoing and more rigorous, includes more parameters, I think, than the bottled water does.
So Rusty Berry just said, well, Charlotte water quality is great, and I'm assuming he means what comes out of the tap, but I think he also means what goes into the processing plant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why is our water so good?
Well, we're blessed to have such an abundant and clean water supply source. Really, in Lake Norman, we get some of our water from Lake Norman for the northern communities and Mountain Island Lake, and it's part of the Catawba River chain. And there's a lot of water coming to us. Lake Norman is very large, settles out a lot of the solids, provides a very, very good source of water, and we're very blessed in that regard.
So I didn't know you were coming, Ron, until today. So I'm hoping I'm not going to ask you a question you can't answer. But if I do, just bat it across the table to somebody else. These tests that I referred to a minute ago from 2015, released this summer, that's 6 months after 2015 ended. No, more than that. 2016, and they were released this summer. That's 6 months after 2016 ended. Why does it take so long to get water quality reports released?
It doesn't. We submit those, and they go into an EPA database, and the report that you're describing was an environmental working group that went through the listing of the analysis and compared it to standards that are set in California. Mm. And those standards are different than the EPA drinking water standards.
They're more stringent.
They're more stringent. California's process is that they have a state board that sets standards just for California. Mm-hmm. And so they have more safety factors built into their standards. And so anywhere that our analysis, our parameter was higher than their standard, they put it on the list as a potential concern.
Bruce, there is an environmental group that's a little concerned about Charlotte drinking water standards, and they are a little suspicious of not just them, other people are a little suspicious of the federal standards. You've done a lot of reporting on this. Do you have any worries about that?
I have not so much worries as I do a shared confusion. You do have on multiple levels two different standards, and if there is a public outcry over something, let's take coal ash, which we've had lots of news about in the last few years, and a compound called hexavalent chromium, which can cause, is believed to cause cancer. When the state started looking at groundwater, it set a precautionary limit, a screening limit, that was many times more stringent than what the state wanted to call a drinking water standard. And the reason is that the more stringent limits are usually based purely on health. It's they use a 1 million and a one cancer in a million criteria for setting those standards. So they tend to be very, very, very low. When you set enforceable standards, which means that if you go across that standard, you're in trouble, you've broken the law, you take into account economics and finances and the practical ability to get to that standard, and so it tends to be higher. The fact that you have those two standards is what confuses a lot of people, and we've seen that around the whole coal ash issue where people have drinking water wells, and they're being told two things. They're being told that it's your water has hexavalent chromium above the health standard that some toxicologists say we ought to use, but it also meets the applicable federal standard, and that just confuses people.
And this is well water. This is not the water that comes out of the tap from Charlotte Water, our public utility. This is water that's in the ground. And Duke Energy says that whatever hexavalent chromium might be in that water is not from their coal ash.
That's what they say.
Why should we believe them?
Well, a Duke University study concluded the same thing.
Okay.
Duke University, with no ties to Duke Energy, looked at the same thing for hexavalent chromium and concluded that it was not coming from the ash. The state, I'll add, has not weighed in on that, has not made a final determination on that.
So we test for 150 contaminants. Is that correct?
Not exactly.
Okay.
We test for more contaminants than that.
Okay.
There are at least 150 that we have tested for and did not detect. And we try to be very transparent about what's in the water. And so you were talking about the timing of getting the data out. You can actually go on the charlottewater.org website, and you can see the water quality data. Every test that we have done, it's mapped. The results are there. We want folks to know what's in the water. We really try hard to get that information out to them. Ron talked about the Environmental Working Group report, but there's also a water quality report that we send out every year, and we do that to let folks know what's in their water and to help them, make decisions for themselves. The Environmental Working Group, is advocating for cleaner water, and that's a good thing. We want the water to be as absolutely possible clean as possible, but there are, as Bruce said, there are there are technological and practical limits as to how clean you can get it. Mm-hmm. And so so we want it to be clean, too. I wish the advocacy groups would advocate for more research into understanding the health impacts. A lot of the things that are being detected in water supplies across the whole world, we don't really understand and know whether it's good or bad. You know, some of these things that are in the water might actually turn out to be good. Who knows? Nobody's doing the research, and there's no information out there. So that's really, I think, one of the most important things in the water industry right now is there needs to be a better understanding of the impacts of what we're seeing.
So you're testing for all these contaminants. Do you do that? Are these tests conducted as it comes out of the tap, or are they conducted before you even treat the water?
Both. There are some requirements that we have to take samples at the plant, in the system, at the farthest ends of the system based upon a study that we had to conduct. And in the case of lead and copper, it has to be from the consumer's tap.
And you are treating this constantly? Because there's millions, hundreds of millions of gallons going through the system every day, right?
We average about 107 million gallons per day throughout Mecklenburg County, serve about 1 million people. And so, yeah, we're continuously testing. There are some parameters that are literally continuously monitored, you know, every second, and there are others that are sampled at different frequencies.
And how do you make sure that the water is as clean as it was when it left you as to when it goes through the pipes miles and miles and miles and comes out of somebody's tap in Ballantyne?
Yeah, but we have sampling stations and locations throughout the distribution system, and we collect samples pretty much every day, you know, from out in the system. So we start sampling at the lake, at Mountain Island Lake in Lake Norman. We start sampling that raw water. We sample it at several points during the treatment process. We sample it and test it when it leaves the treatment plant. And then we sample and test it out in the distribution system, out at those extremities, and then in some cases from the faucets in the homes. We want to be sure that we know what's going on in the water system.
As the population here has increased and development has increased to keep up with the population, Rusty, as more surface area becomes impermeable, is this becoming an increasing challenge to keep the water clean?
It is. That's a concern. We've adopted regulations here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg to collect, treat that stormwater before it runs into our water supply reservoirs, creeks, and lakes. And the regulations we've adopted are very stringent. They've got a lot of very specific requirements. The other thing about Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which is very unique, as a matter of fact, I don't know of any other community that does this, but Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services has a very extensive lake monitoring program where we monitor for thousands of parameters way upstream of our water resources up in Lake Norman on up towards Iredell County, and we're monitoring for a number of parameters. And we also do continuous automated monitoring in those lakes. So we've got a lot of resources out there checking water everywhere.
We also have periodic sewage spills, but that's all downstream from where we mostly. Hasn't it all been downstream of where we pull the water out for drinking water?
Not always. Not always.
There was a big spill on Mountain Island Lake 10 years ago, Barry.
We do have more sewer spills than we would like. We've done a lot of work through the years to drive them down, and actually we're at the lowest level of sewer spills that we've been in my career at Charlotte Water, and we're continuing to keep shooting for less.
Barry Gullett is director of Charlotte Water. Rusty Rozelle and Ron Hargrove are also here from Charlotte Water, and Bruce Henderson from the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing patients with customized care and treatment plans designed to help them regain mobility to live life with a full range of motion. More at novanthealth.org/motion. And Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at duke-energy.com/future. The start of the school year at CMS is just a few weeks away, but other schools here and around the state have already opened. Schools are always a topic of keen interest here, and there are many issues making headlines this fall, from struggling charter schools to problems with school vouchers and the ever-present debate over teacher pay raises. We sit down with two education reporters to get a clearer picture of all this on this program tomorrow at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, after the blockbuster announcement, a U.S. team successfully edited human embryos. Now come the tough medical and ethical questions. We'll talk it through. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte Water, literally. That's the name of the utility, but also what we drink, with Bruce Gullett, director of Charlotte Water, Ron Hargrove, the deputy utilities director, Rusty Rozell, the water quality program manager for stormwater services here, and Bruce Henderson, an environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're just talking about bottled water during the break again, and you mentioned, Ron, that they have to they purify bottled water like we purify our water, and then they have to add
preservatives,
because if they didn't add gives it a shelf life.
That gives it a shelf life.
And if they didn't add the preservatives, what would the water be like in this bottle of water?
It depends on where it comes from, what the source is. I personally have tested for bacteria in bottled water and found it
really?
Before. Yes. We've seen bottled water come in with sediment or precipitation in it, solids.
Uh-huh.
You check it up and it has all kinds of little floating things in it. So you don't know really where it's coming from. There's a lot of advertisement behind bottled water, but there is a preservative that gets added, so it will stay on the shelf at least 6 months.
Okay. There's a lot of suspicion out there about municipal water services because of the horror story that came out of Flint, Michigan, about the lead in the water there once they changed their water source, et cetera. Wasn't their water tested along the way for compliance with federal standards? How did it get so out of hand there? What happened there, and why won't it happen here?
The issues in Flint started from money. The issues in Flint were really a people failure and a governance failure. Flint had used the Flint River as a water supply source 50 or 60 years ago and had been successful. And they had a water treatment plant that had not been operated in that time period. And when they restarted that water treatment plant, they left out some pretty critical steps in the treatment process. I don't know why
ignorance
they did that.
Ignorance or money?
I don't know why they did that. They weren't necessarily expensive steps, but they were left out. And leaving out those important steps, and the main one of which was corrosion control, treatment for corrosion control, is really what led to their problems. And we in Charlotte have a very successful corrosion control program. It's always been part of our water treatment process, and we monitor it very closely.
But have any of you heard from people who use the water about they're increasingly concerned because of what happened in Flint, what we're hearing about in Wilmington? Are you hearing that they're actually concerned about our water?
I haven't heard anything that's very specific, but I think in general everyone is concerned about their water. I think everyone is concerned about chemical safety and about the environment that they live in, and so water is part of that. I think that, you know, there's so much publicity over the last few years about water quality, about drinking water quality, about quality in the lakes, even about things like the issues that Whitewater had. All of that negative publicity around water erodes confidence, and so we think it's important at Charlotte Water that people understand their water system and that they have a trust in their utility to be doing the right things and to be very upfront and a couple of transparent about what's going on. A couple of years ago, there were issues with THMs. They weren't above the standards, but they were higher than normal. And we were doing news conferences, and we were putting out a lot of information telling our customers what was going on, even though we were working like crazy to manage that in the system, to keep the system flushed and to keep those THM levels below the standard.
Is that trihalomethanes? Is that what
trihalomethanes, that's THM.
What is that?
Trihalomethanes are a disinfection byproduct. When you add chlorine to drinking water to disinfect it, and chlorine in drinking water is a really effective and very protective addition. And when you add chlorine, it's a very powerful oxidant, and it reacts with everything in the water and creates other compounds. And some of those compounds are in this family of chemicals called trihalomethanes. And they, the industry in the world understands trihalomethanes better now than they did 15 or 20 years ago. And the standards keep coming down and down. And we are, in Charlotte Water, we are working to keep our numbers below those standards and have been very successful at that.
The Environmental Working Group, which you have referred to, looked at Charlotte's levels of these THMs, and they compared it to California, which California says their levels have to be 100 times lower than the federal standard, and Charlotte Water says California's guidelines are specific to that state. What does that mean?
Well, there's two things there. I think there was a proposal. This is what I have read and understood about this, is that there was a proposal in California to lower their standards to 0.8 parts per billion for THMs. The standard is 80 parts per billion. And my understanding is that that proposal never went anywhere, and that actually the California board that Ron referenced earlier actually adopted the 80, which is the EPA standard, and that's what's in effect, mm-hmm. that they didn't adopt the 0.8. 0.8 is an incredibly low amount. I don't know if the technology even exists to get water to that level. I'd really doubt it.
Bruce, who is the Environmental Working Group? Who are they?
They are headed by a former deputy administrator at EPA, mm-hmm. Who I believe worked in the George W. Bush administration. They do have a reputation, and in this case, they are relying on federal data. They're not just making numbers up. But their point was, Mike, is going back to this double standard that I talked about a little while ago, and that is that you have California saying mm-hmm. that the healthy limit for THMs are way, way low, or 100 times lower than what the federal safety standard is, the standard being the one that's enforceable. And so it's, again, trying to balance the practicality of reaching that really, really low standard, the expense of doing that, and then, frankly, how many lives do you save by doing that? And so it sort of just illustrates, they're saying the federal standard is not low enough, the enforceable standard.
And these are guys who used to work for the federal government.
Yes, yes. They when they do these kind of reports, they always have a point to make, right? And the point in this case was the standards need to be more stringent than they are.
Well, they've said, this woman, I guess it's a woman, in Ineka Liba, who is the director of Healthy Living Science for the Environmental Working Group, says the blame rests not on utilities but with the government because the standards are a compromise between health and political and economic limits. She's saying, or he or she's saying, that the government is more business friendly. Is that what they're saying?
I think she's saying that the government is a little more practical than she would like for it to be. Water utilities are very sensitive about their water rates. I think Barry would agree with that. And if you started testing and started treating water to a standard that's 100 times more stringent than the one that you're testing for now, it's going to drive up cost, and that's just for one chemical. If you multiply that by 150, the cost would go up as well. And so I think federal standards, which can take decades to set, try to strike a balance between what is healthy and what is practical. And that does include economics.
And to the best of our knowledge, I'm not sure which one of you to ask this of, given the federal standards that we comply with and usually come in below, I mean, we usually come in better than the federal standard.
We always do.
No one's gotten sick from our water, correct? Should that be the yardstick?
I'm not aware of anyone who's gotten sick from our water. I'll be honest with you. I don't really know what the yardstick should be. I think the yardstick should be that we need to make the water as clean as we can. And so there are practical limits to that. There are technical limits to that. Getting disinfection byproducts to THM levels to the 0.8 level that the Environment Working Group put out, I'm not sure that's even possible. Much less practical. That is an incredibly, incredibly small number. And so again, going back to my point, I think the more important thing is to understand what are the health impacts at the various levels.
Right.
And I don't know that there's enough research and understanding and agreement in the industry, in the science world now, to make that kind of leap.
To get the water clean, although our source, Rusty, is clean, you say, but not clean enough to drink, one would think, you have to add all kinds of chemicals. You've got to add other chemicals to get the chemicals that you added out. You have to filter the water through these incredible filters that you have to deal with. What is the process?
Well, it's not exactly like you laid it out there. I think the perception is that we do add a lot of chemicals to the water, and that really just isn't correct.
Right.
We do add a few chemicals. Each one has a very specific purpose, and they're well understood. Adding chlorine is the one we hear the most about. A lot of people say they can taste the chlorine, and maybe they can, but the reality is that chlorine is there to protect customers from the bacteria, from the typhoid and the cholera and all the diseases that 100 years ago people died from drinking the water. You know, the disinfection of drinking water is barely 100 years old. Yeah. As a treatment technique, as a treatment process. And 100 years ago, people didn't understand germ theory the way they do now. Right. Even.
That's why people drank beer back then. And it's true. And Bruce, you report that our water's particularly good for brewing beer. What's up with that?
Yes, it is. hats off to Charlotte Water for this year and its water quality report saying it's really good for beer, too. Just a special note for the brewers out there.
Because of the soft nature of it or because of something else?
I couldn't do a chemical analysis.
Okay.
I think it maybe has something to do with the hardness of the water as well.
I really don't understand all that either. I'm not a beer maker, but we do hear that it makes good beer. I think it has to do with the mineral content.
Right.
It is a very soft water that we have here in Charlotte, and I'm glad that it works. And but it's a good point that Charlotte Water is used for so many different things throughout the community. It's used in all the microbreweries and everything that popped up, but also the food processing industries that are here, the hospitals, all the healthcare facilities, manufacturing, fire protection. There are just a tremendous number of uses and ways that Charlotte Water supports the community.
On the Environmental Working Group's website, they say that 8 contaminants were detected in Charlotte's drinking water in 2015. This is 2 years ago now. Bromodichloromethane, which evidently causes cancer or is allegedly a cause of cancer, bromoform, chloroform, chromium hexavalent, and several other cancer-causing agents. But they hasten to say that we still fall within federal guidelines. So after reviewing the claim, Charlotte Water responded that they were disappointed that the working group elected to display the information in this manner. What did that mean, and why shouldn't we be concerned about that?
Well, first of all, the list of chemicals that they have there is redundant. Several of the chemicals that they list are actually part of that group of chemicals, that family of chemicals called THMs.
Okay.
And so that is one piece. The other piece is that the data that they pulled from was the year that we were experiencing higher than normal THM levels because of an unusual spike in bromide in the lakes that we were pulling from.
What was the source of that?
Well, the source of that was been pretty well distributed, acknowledged, and published that it was coming from Duke Energy's work to prevent air pollution. In other words, they were pre-treating their coal with a solution that would help capture the mercury from the coal to keep it from being released into the atmosphere. And then that contributed to an unintended consequence, which was a spike in the bromide in the lakes. When we pointed it out to them, they said, oh, wow, we didn't realize, that we're having that impact. And they stopped. And once they stopped, then it took a little while, but the bromide levels have returned back to what we had normally seen, and our THM levels have dropped. Again, we were very transparent with our customers. We were out front talking to them. I stood on the steps of the government center and did a news conference about that. We stood in front of council and reported that. It was widely reported. We were letting folks know what was going on. Even though we were in compliance, it was an unusual occurrence for us. And anytime there's something unusual going on with the drinking water, whether it exceeds EPA standards or not, if it's unusual, our goal is to let our customers know about it.
We do have these coal ash ponds that are on very close to Mountain Island Lake in some cases. And are you at all concerned, Rusty, that any of that is leaching out or that we could have a catastrophic failure? And if we did have a catastrophic failure, what would that mean for our drinking water supply?
Well, we do a lot of testing in the lake around that discharge point from the coal ash basins where they're dewatering. And we've been testing there for a number of years. And we even have one of our automated monitoring units there testing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we're actively looking to see if there are any impacts. And if we find anything, we report it and make sure that it stopped.
Have you found anything?
Yes, we did.
How often?
A year ago, this past May, we had some elevated levels of arsenic that we detected, and we reported it to Duke Energy, and they stopped their discharge, and they implemented their treatment system. At that time, they haven't begun treating the water. They implemented a treatment system, and the levels dropped back down, and they started discharging again.
Meanwhile, there are concerns in Wilmington, North Carolina, where residents get their drinking water from the Cape Fear River. That water there has been tainted with a chemical byproduct, evidently for decades. The Cape Fear Public Utility Authority co-authored a 3-year study, but according to CBS News, the findings were never made public, not even to Wilmington's mayor. How do we know that there aren't similar studies in Charlotte that have never been made public?
Well, I want to point out a couple of things about that. One is that it really illustrates how we're all in this together. In other words, the water supply source isn't just Charlotte's water supply source, or it isn't just Wilmington's water supply source. Wilmington is on the Cape Fear River, which is a very large basin. We are on a river basin that's much smaller, but there are 18 public water supply utilities that share this river. And so we work together. In fact, we're going to a meeting of that group in just a few minutes. But we work together to understand what's going on in each one of our communities, to understand who our industries are, what's being discharged into the water. If one of us finds something unusual, we share that.
And the New York Times reports that in the United States, there is a nearly 1 in 4 chance that tap water is either unsafe to drink or has not been properly monitored for contaminants in accordance with federal law. And one of the reasons is due to a lack of reporting that consumers can use. Why do we seem to have that reporting while other areas do not?
Well, I really can't speak to what other utilities are doing. I know that the most of the larger utilities across the country are very open and very transparent with what they're doing and the water quality that they're producing. Again, it's on our website. Ours is all out there, and we want to continue to put it out there. We're working hard to make it closer to real time. What I would really like to see is real-time reporting. When it comes out of the lab, it goes on the internet, and so everybody can see what's out there. We have nothing to hide. Our water is great. We want folks to know that. When we do have an issue, we want them to know that too.
Bruce Gullett is director of Charlotte Water. Ron Hargrove is the deputy utilities director. Rusty Rozell is with the water. He's the water quality program manager for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services. And Bruce Henderson, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. When we come back, we talk about something that loves water, mosquitoes, and how we are the 9th city in the country for mosquito infestation. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and HeartMath Tutoring. Volunteers spend 1 hour each week helping students in high-poverty Charlotte elementary schools develop math skills and academic confidence. Volunteer opportunities at hearttutoring.org. And Heartwood Tree Service, EAB, was discovered in Charlotte this past June and will severely impact the tree canopy. Heartwood's EAB newsletter has information about the pest and how to protect trees. EABCharlotte.com. For the first time in the U.S., researchers say they have successfully edited human embryos. After the blockbuster announcement, a discussion about some of the tough medical and ethical questions. That'll be the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with guest host Jane Clayson during On Point. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment on this program, so stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
There's a presidential election tomorrow in Rwanda, and the man almost certain to win is considered a national hero by many. Incumbent Paul Kagame has been...
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The 5-3 vote reversed the commission's January vote endorsing a plan to rebuild Memorial Stadium near Uptown.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. As the climate warms, insect-borne diseases are becoming an increasing concern. No one had heard of the Zika virus until a few summers ago. It was confined to the tropics, gradually making its presence known in Miami. But in 2016, North Carolina reported over 100 cases of travel-associated Zika. That means travelers brought it here after being bitten by an infected mosquito elsewhere. Mosquitoes cause more human suffering than any other organisms, and Charlotte is among the top 50 mosquito-plagued cities, according to Orkin. So we're going to look at these itchy biters, at efforts to control them, and at a research project aimed at determining the best ways to predict where mosquito-borne diseases will occur. Ari Whiteman is a doctoral student at UNC Charlotte and founder and director of the Urban Mosquito Project. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here.
I want to point out that he's wearing short sleeve shirt and shorts, so he's not too terribly afraid of mosquitoes today. UNC Charlotte's Dr. Dan Janis focuses on the evolution and spread of pathogens in research conducted for the Department of Defense and has developed a kind of weather map for disease, allowing public health scientists to visualize when and where pathogens jump from animals and humans. He's also with the Urban Mosquito Project and from UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being here, too.
Thanks for having us.
If you agree with Orkin, and I think you do, that Charlotte is on the list of top 50 mosquito-plagued cities, we're number 9, why? What makes us so attractive to mosquitoes?
So there are a few different reasons why Charlotte in particular is a hot spot for mosquito activity. First and foremost is the climate. Obviously, it's very hot in the summers here. We have quite mild winters. We also get a lot of rain. You know, it's raining today. It's in the summertime, it generally rains every day or every other day. And so that provides lots of breeding habitat for mosquitoes. We also have a rapidly urbanizing population. The mosquitoes that I'm particularly interested in studying are quite tied to people. And the reason for that is they're called container breeders. That means they actually breed in man-made containers, whether it be flower pots or wheelbarrows or whatever. These are man-made containers that these mosquitoes are breeding in. So a growing city combined with the climate that we have puts us in a position where we have quite a few of these flying around every
day. And as it gets warmer, which I'm told it is, are we going to experience more of this or different varieties of mosquitoes who will be migrating north?
So temperature definitely makes a difference in terms of both the population dynamics of the vector as well as the dynamics at which diseases can potentially spread. The warmer the air is, the faster the mosquitoes grow. Now, what that means is they also die faster, so they kind of live fast and die young. That's both a good thing because it's less time that they can actually transmit viruses, but it's maybe a bad thing. It's sort of a double-edged sword because they can grow faster and population turnover is more rapid.
These container mosquitoes that you study, is that fundamentally the mosquito that we have here?
Well, we have lots of different types of mosquitoes. I think on Earth there are over 3,500 species of mosquitoes.
Wow.
However, the medically important ones number in, you know, maybe 5 to 10, maybe in this area.
By medically important, you mean they're disease carriers.
Yeah. There are not too many that you know, in relation to all of the species of mosquitoes that actually are medically important. I think the last time I checked in North Carolina, we have like 145 species of mosquitoes, but we're really concerned about 3 or 4 of them.
I mentioned this in the opening, but I was actually shocked to read that mosquitoes cause more human suffering than any other organism. Really, when we say suffering, is it because of the diseases that they transmit? Is that what it is?
Yes, viral diseases and malaria as well. And malaria is
right. The
big one. But the viral diseases are a concern because they're on the rise. The geographic extent of dengue and number of cases per year has experienced a 30-fold increase in the last 50 years.
So these viruses that these insects carry, where do they pick them up? From other humans, from animals, from what source?
Evolutionarily from animals,
But during an epidemic, the virus is in, for example, in Zika virus, it's in the mosquito, infects a person. That person is bitten by another mosquito and completes the cycle into other humans.
Why are there certain viruses that can be transmitted by from humans to mosquitoes and mosquitoes to humans, and other viruses don't transfer? Why?
Well, I think just going back to that, what Dan was talking about, I don't think most people realize you have to get bit by a mosquito twice for it to actually transfer the virus to somebody else. If I have the virus, one mosquito has to bite me to uptake the virus and then bite you to give you the virus. So that mosquito has to bite two different people for the virus to actually be transmitted. And that's actually factored into some of the equations when we talk about what we call vectorial capacity, which is the capacity for a population of vectors to transmit a disease. So there has to be a lot of mosquitoes, but there also has to be a lot of people who have the virus to begin with.
But correct, they can't transmit every virus. They don't transmit HIV, right?
No.
Why not?
This is more Dan's wheelhouse, but there are certain viruses that have evolved to be picked up by mosquitoes, and they've kind of co-evolved to be spread together.
If you're bitten and you have a variety of viruses in your blood, only the viruses that can pass from the gut of the mosquito into its saliva to be reinjected into the next victim are the ones going.
And what makes that possible? Is it the size of the virus? Is it something else at work?
The physiology of the virus with respect to the animal's gut.
Okay. You are, Ari, the founder and director of the Urban Mosquito Project. What is that?
So it's a multifaceted effort to both understand the way that mosquitoes are living in our community, the risk of disease in our community. It's also an outreach project. We're trying to educate people, educate the community on ways to prevent the spread of mosquito-borne diseases. And also, even ignoring diseases, people hate mosquitoes. If there were no viruses, you know, people would still hate mosquitoes. So, we try to talk to people about ways that they can prevent these things from flying around in the neighborhood. But I think at our core, we're a research program, and we're interested in looking at what the drivers are of mosquito distribution. So in particular, why some neighborhoods seem to have more than others, why the distribution of mosquitoes seems to vary across certain gradients, whether it be environmental gradients, socioeconomic gradients. We're looking at a whole host of different variables. It's quite a novel project. And it's quite interdisciplinary, lots of different variables involved.
What are we learning? Because I thought we already knew all this. I thought that we knew that there are factors in the environment that led to more mosquitoes being in a place and more mosquito activity, like standing water in pots and tires,
right,
and unclean underbrush and things like that.
Well, we do know a lot. You know, we know how temperature impacts mosquitoes. We know how breeding habitat availability affects mosquitoes. What's really novel about our project is that we're looking at things across the socioeconomic gradient. So we're looking at questions such as, are high-income communities at a greater risk than low-income communities and vice versa? So for instance, you know, we know that water is a main factor, a main driver of mosquitoes. Is standing water more prevalent in high-income or low-income areas? Those are questions that we don't really know the answers to.
Really?
There's been a couple studies that have been going on in just the last year or so that have found some really cool results that there do seem to be relationships between the socioeconomic status of the neighborhood and its ability to its capacity to create a burgeoning mosquito population.
So, are you saying that lower socioeconomic neighborhoods have more mosquitoes, or the other way around?
Well, it's really interesting. So, the only work that's been done actually found that it related to precipitation, to rain, and they found that this was from a study in Baltimore and D.C., and they found that during periods of high rain, there were more mosquitoes in low-income neighborhoods. Yet during periods of low rain, there were more mosquitoes in high-income neighborhoods.
Why?
And what they attributed that to is basically there are more unused containers lying around in low-income neighborhoods. So when it rains, those containers accumulate with water. People aren't paying attention to them. They don't dump them out, and they become breeding grounds for mosquitoes. Yet during periods of low rain, those unused containers don't fill up with rain, and yet in high-income neighborhoods, all the irrigation, fountains and pools and sprinklers and whatever, those tend to fill up buckets that even if they're more if they're maintained more frequently, they become the dominant breeding habitat across this, that urban region.
You're focusing, I'm going to say this incorrectly, on the Aedes mosquito.
Yes.
How do you say it?
Aedes. Yeah.
Aedes mosquito. Mm-hmm. Aedes, which is responsible for transmitting the viruses that cause Zika, dengue fever, yellow fever, and several other diseases. How common are these mosquitoes here in Charlotte?
So that's a very good question. There are two specific types of Aedes that we're interested in. One is Aedes aegypti, and one is Aedes albopictus. Aegypti is the primary vector for Zika, among other diseases. We do not have aegypti here. We used to. I think the last time it was found here was in the 1980s. And the reason we don't have it anymore is because of this other species, Aedes albopictus. That was introduced from Japan in some shipments of tires in the 1980s. It has since become an invasive species and spread across the southeast. And it's basically eradicated this primary vector from the area.
Is now, that because the other mosquitoes are eating the other? Or
I don't think they eat
crowding
them.
Crowding them out?
Yeah, you're going to have to I'm not sure how the actual dynamic works, but there is some level of competition which prevents aegypti from occurring in areas where there are large populations of albopictus.
I'm actually astounded about something you said, that city dwellers I think city dwellers do feel safe. You would associate these mosquitoes with beach areas and the country where there's a lot of forestation. But city dwellers are the most at-risk people for mosquitoes, really.
Well, there's just lots of breeding habitat around. I mean, you look outside and there are all kinds of containers around that collect water. I mean, I urge your residents, your listeners who are out in Charlotte today on the rainy day, just go out and look in their backyard and see where water is collected. Try to think like a mosquito and you'll be amazed how many cryptic little places you can find where water is collected. That combined with the fact that people in cities are outside a lot, we're walking around. In the summertime, people are active, especially at dawn and dusk when these mosquitoes are quite active as well. All of that seems to come together to create a system where biting frequency is high. And, you know, we don't hope this, but it seems like disease frequency could be quite high as well.
Well, we're number 9 on the list here in Charlotte. Chicago and New York are in the top 5. Atlanta's higher than we are on the list. Washington, D.C., which, as you pointed out before we started, is a swamp for more reasons than one.
Yes.
Actually was founded on a swamp. But Minneapolis is not on the list, and I've always heard that Minneapolis have mosquitoes the size of B-52s. So why aren't they on this list?
Well, I have very little experience with Minneapolis in particular. I know that I haven't seen this particular list, but it may have been focusing on a particular species, these ones that we're commonly seeing in the southeast, these Aedes mosquitoes. Aedes mosquitoes are not very commonly found up north. I don't think they overwinter as well as they do here, and so that might be one of the reasons.
So why don't we have more incidences of Zika, dengue fever, yellow fever, malaria, et cetera, in this part of the world?
Well, Aedes aegypti only occurs in pockets in the southeast and in pockets in California. Aedes albopictus has much greater cold tolerance, and so there are cases, for example, where chikungunya virus can have a single mutation in the virus and can jump from aegypti to albopictus. And if it does that in the Americas, it happened in Asia already, if it does that in the Americas, chikungunya will spread much more into the central and northern United States.
So you've developed this software, Doctor, to put pathogenic genomic data into context with geography and hosts. I'm not sure what that means, but I know you're going to explain it to me. Does the Mosquito Project fit into that, or is that something?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So this Aedes aegypti, Aedes albopictus is a great example. So imagine a band across the Gulf states and a couple pockets in California where Aedes aegypti occurs can carry Zika. Zika, if and when it figures out how to get into albopictus, imagine a much broader band across the whole mid-Atlantic states, across the Midwest to all the way to California, almost to the Canadian border in some cases, where we're under Zika risk. Yeah. for example.
And you've developed this, if I'm not mistaken, for the Department of Defense.
That's correct. Right?
Yeah. Why? Why do they care?
Well, the Department of Defense is very interested in force protection, okay? So they have people all over the world who are exposed to infectious diseases, and they want to care for their soldiers and their soldiers' families when those soldiers come home. Furthermore, the burden of disease around the world can cause unrest and so forth, and that's something we should be watching.
And you deal with genomics and bioinformatics.
That's correct.
And I know that there are several companies, and I think other research institutions have been experimenting with a way to lower the mosquito population by introducing into that population sterile males. What does that do?
Well, behaviorally, the females will mate with these sterile males, but the matings will be unsuccessful and will very much reduce the next generation of mosquitoes produced. So it just reduces the numbers completely.
So we're tampering with the ecosystem.
That's correct.
Right? I mean, there's a reason, aside from biting us and being a nuisance, there's a reason mosquitoes exist.
They're a food organism for birds probably and other organisms.
Well, it's interesting. So I mentioned earlier that there are 3,500 species of mosquitoes. The evidence shows so far that if we were to eradicate the small handful that cause us problems, we would not see major repercussions in the ecosystem.
I only have 30 seconds, but last summer we were all concerned about Zika. This summer, heard nothing about it. What happened?
Well, diseases go in waves. We could be experiencing herd immunity in South America in particular, where transmission is less likely.
Yeah.
If I had to make a bet, I think I would bet that either Zika or some other related virus is going to be back again soon.
Let us know the results of your mosquito project, the Urban Mosquito Project. Ari Whiteman is the founder and director of that. Dr. Dan Janis is also with UNC Charlotte doing research in bioinformatics and genomics. Thank you both.